Purpose. Angela Phillips' quintessential guide to, our bodies, ourselves. Duration. It's one of those books I think I should keep by the toilet. A true reference text, especially if you're interested in seeing women rocking a 70s bush in black and white. Equipment needed. A hand mirror, I suppose. Not really required. Age, 17. Relationship status. I'm 17 and have had like 2 kisses tops. One involved tongue. Employment. Country Fair's Cinnamon Rolls Bakery. I roll out the dough in the window. My parents are extremely proud, as if I'm performing quadruple bypass surgery. Cost, $19.05 in paperback. Humiliation factor. Is mortification the same as humiliation? Location, 405 Freeway, Costa Mesa, California. Our family is driving somewhere, all 4 of us. My father is at the wheel of our butter-colored gray market diesel Mercedes. With all his stressful work trips to Europe and the strength of the dollar, it was an expense we could swing. My mother and I are in the back seat, we both prefer it, which means Renee is in the front shotgun position where she likes it, right hand to Dad. While she's quiet, she's quite identified as being a formidable driver. She can help keep Dad on the road, or at least some part of it, hopefully the right. He drifts left when bored. Which leaves my mother and me to our conversation. There's no obvious segue with us. We jump wherever the other goes. I'm concerned about kissing and my level of performance. Interesting. Say more. Now keep in mind, Dad and Renee are about 4 inches away from us, but there is not a peep that this is a tidbit of conversation that either of them wants to be a part of. Well, there's nothing particularly romantic on the horizon, but I figure I should be prepared. My junior high and high school obsession, Ross, still has absolutely zero interest in me. But my mother is big on preparation, so she'll get this. When we visit Lake Tahoe, for some reason, she practices rowing a decaying rowboat from the dock to the buoy, all 50 feet and back, until her 30 minutes are up, prepping for some nautical Armageddon. On the preparation front, my mother wants me to know more about life than she did at my age, hence the Our Bodies Ourselves, delivered oh so subtly to my desk a few months ago. But there's nothing in there about kissing. Menstrual flow? Absolutely. Home births? Of course. The occasional tip cervix? Sure. Tongue placement and kissing? Not a word. I think kissing is a feminist issue, I say. Don't you? I look at Mom quizzically, yet certain that I state the obvious. And if I go intellectual, this may mask some of my performance anxiety on the matter. I mean, shouldn't I know what I'm doing in that department so that life or whatever goes smoothly? Shouldn't all girls know about these things? Why don't they teach this in health class? Well, Megan, sure. Yes, yes, feminist, I suppose. Now, what do you want to know exactly? So if a guy leans in, at what point do I close my eyes? And do I tilt my head right or left? I mean, what if I go right and he goes right? But I don't know because I've already closed my eyes. Let me think. My mother mulls this. She starts tilting her head to herself. Right, pause, then left, pause. Again, nothing coming from the front seat. We might as well be on different planets. Renee's pretending not to hear. I'm sure of it. Fair questions, Megan. Now, I'm no expert, but seems to me the logical thing is to keep your eyes open long enough to see which way he's headed. No sense bobbing your head in the dark. Knowledge is power, so get as much as you can before closing. Then, I suppose, close your eyes after mouth-to-mouth contact. Mouth-to-mouth contact. Got it. Then what? Well, then softly open your mouth. Well, if he does, maybe. Well, just be receptive, as it were. Receptive. Okay. Receptive to his tongue or his mouth or what? I suppose open to either. I mean, if the idea appeals to you. If the idea appeals to me. Do I start moving my tongue around, like a certain direction? I heard not to go crazy like a windmill or anything. It's a bit of a dance. A dance. Well, what sort of dance? A cha-cha? A rumba? A waltz? Maybe a tango. They say the tango is like sexual chess. My mother draws out the shh syllable in the word sexual. Sexual. Always has. Makes me squeamish. Well, I don't know how to tango, and I don't play chess. Let me see. A tango of the mouth. A tango. She surprises herself with a small laugh at her own joke. Shall I just show you? Shall I kiss you? Maybe for practical purposes? Would that be easier? What? What did my mother just say to me? Shall she just show me by kissing me? For practical purposes? Mom, are you nuts? That's disgusting. That's like child molesting. You realize that? You'd be like molesting me. Molesting you? I'm just trying to be helpful. You know that it's not, like, normal to offer to French kiss your own daughter, right? How is it that I'm having to explain this? No reaction from the front seat. Surely, if anything was going to get a rise out of those two, it would be this. I'm just trying to be helpful, Megan. It wouldn't mean what? Oh, yes, it would. It would absolutely mean that. Thank God I know this is not okay. Think of the therapy or the Child Protective Services investigation that a gesture like this could spark. What does it mean that this doesn't even faze my mother? Should I be concerned? Why isn't anyone else in the car saying anything? There are four of us in the car, are there not? Barf, barf, barf! Mom, I'm going to pretend like you never said that. Like, never ever. Never ever ever. I'm never telling anyone you just offered to French kiss me. Seriously, do I really have to explain this? Oh, Megan, I just want you to have the information you want, and I don't know how else to get it to you. In the very least, you could have offered to pantomime with a pillow or something, or a small sponge, or a mirror. Why jump straight to a live demo here in the car? Okay, well, we don't have a pillow or a sponge or a mirror here, now do we? My sister pushes my father in the forearm. He's starting to drift. He must be nodding off. Nodding off. During this. I myself want to go unconscious. Why am I the only one hearing this conversation? Or am I? Is it one of those, if a tree falls in the woods when no one is around, does it still make a sound situations? Like, if I'm the only one who heard it, did it actually happen? If I would prefer to think that it didn't? And does it still count as crazy or minimally and avoided crazy if I'm the only one to hear or know? I'm embarrassed for my mother and ashamed. I feel pity and sympathy and heat and sorrow. All these states rise in me and I swallow down something like a silent, wordless scream. I can't talk about these things with anyone. These are the things I do not say, feelings I do not describe. Protecting my mother from judgment from anyone else feels more important than just about anything. I try to make it funny instead. I will not kiss again for another 3 years. Chapter 14. The Art of Sexual Ecstasy. Purpose. A Love and Ecstasy Training Manual for Western Lovers by Margot Anand. Duration. It's quite a big book. Equipment needed. Don't get me started. Age, 20. Relationship status, none. Employment, temping and waiting tables while home from school. Cost, it was a gift. Location, Balboa Island, California. My parents have moved since I started college. I'm not really sure what to make of this one. Dad has given all of us hardback copies of The Art of Sexual Ecstasy. Not that Dad knows my sexual status. I'm still a virgin, but they know Renee's. When she was first home from college, years ago now, I had stumbled upon the contents of her quilted Peer de Purse. Honestly, what legitimate reason did I have to be rooting around in there? And inside, I found an unused pregnancy test. Upon finding the test, I confronted Renee, and she didn't so much confess as rightly refused to answer. But she has a terrible poker face, a trait we share. Her eye darting is her tell. Her eye darts said yes. With this revelation, I ran to my parents' closet, locked myself in, and wept. Why? Was unmarried sex naughty? Bad with a capital B? Parent disappointing? I wept until they returned home from their seminar when I emerged from their closet, blurting it all out in some bizarre epileptic fit as if it were normal to confess my guilt about her sex life as my own. I hated keeping secrets, not understanding the difference between dishonesty and discretion. Much to Renee's horror, it became a family affair to wait for the results of that little blue stick, negative. If I were Renee, I don't know if I could ever forgive me. So needless to say, daughter sex hadn't been a family topic for some time. and I had nothing new of my own to confess. Hadn't even had a boyfriend yet. And to be clear, when I say Dad has given all of us a copy, I mean it goes beyond our nuclear family. It's his new favorite gift. He recently gave it to my cousin Connie for her wedding. I wish I could have seen her face when he hand-delivered it. Yes, I think he hand-delivered. She married a very fresh-faced, incredibly innocent-looking Christian Science practitioner. Come to think of it, maybe that's how this all started. Since Christian Scientists don't exactly think they have physical bodies, what with matter being an illusion and all, maybe Dad thinks he got ripped off because no one ever taught him about his body. According to the table of contents, Dad must think I should open my inner flute, heal my yoni, and deliver a nice anal healing massage. Although the last one doesn't get covered till chapter 10. If all this comes together right, after I've learned feathering and the PC pump, then I can ride the tiger, shoot the crown, and eventually graduate into riding the wave of bliss. I have no idea how to approach this verbally, let alone physically. I'm going to take this one in silence. I don't think I can use humor as a psychological salve with Dad on this one. Well, that's what my yoni told me. Chapter 15, International Wilderness Training Course. Purpose: to be the leading source and teacher of wilderness skills serving both people and the environment. Duration: courses vary in length from a month to a semester. Equipment needed: a staggering gear check at the branch in Chile. While much can be rented, you are required to buy your own polypropylene underpants. At home, despite my new backcountry travel light philosophy, my mother has insisted I buy my own dresser so I know I'm starting my own life, not continuing theirs. I now own an IKEA maple veneer dresser. Age 22/23. Relationship status: started dating a guy named Lowry about 3 minutes ago. He thinks I'll travel to Patagonia and fall for an instructor. How ridiculous. Employment: Princeton Review, SAT instructor, and waitress. Cost: at the time, a semester course cost about $4,500. Location: Cochrane, Chile, where we will bag our rations and stage our gear, then travel for 2 days on one very bumpy dirt road to the heart of Patagonia. 5 months post-college graduation pre-course. Location: The Wedge, Newport Beach, California. After saturating myself in my collegial political philosophy texts and Lawrence's classes, I know I need to make more than just theoretical sense of what Rousseau saw as a corrosive overdependence on what others think and what others think of us. And somewhere, in the back of my eyeballs, I not only feel this, but also sense what Plato calls the shadows on the cave, where we humans are chained to a cave wall since childhood, unable to see the full nature of things. Instead, we merely see shadows on the walls, the closest we'll get to seeing reality, that is, unless, and it's a big unless, we figure out how to unchain ourselves from the cave. But honestly, I don't need a college degree to tell me I need help with my own cave, or some sort of cave extraction. My mother and father keep growing more distant from one another by the day. How can I merge the out-there metaphysical musings of Dad about physics and dwarf stars with the very close-to-home nature of my mother's desire for safety and reassurance from her spouse? And why couldn't I really have a boyfriend? Don't I want one? Why doesn't love find me? I want to turn my world upside down, like taking one of those glass balls with water and glittery snow inside it and giving it a really good shake. I have this idea that climbing around on glaciers and paddling across big, broad water and speaking a language not native to me is what it would mean to be shaken up. It's been a stressful couple of years finishing college. When my parents dropped me off as a freshman, they dropped me off together. But Mom drove back alone. Needed time to think, she said. Now they've sold the family home and they're living part-time in Lake Tahoe and part-time in Newport. Dad comes up to visit when he can. They don't call it a separation. They say they're just avoiding capital gains by establishing a new residence. But it still seems like a separation. I wish they'd get on with it, if that's where they're headed. As much as I think about my future, I don't yet know how to unravel my future from theirs. They don't like this international wilderness backcountry thing. I have a talk with Dad on the Balboa Peninsula so we could walk on the wedge. As we walk, he goes on and on about my not being dreamy. But I don't think it's dreamy, what I want right now. I want to feel raw and pushed to my limits and extreme, like I used to feel when I danced. I crave intensity, something larger than me, larger than this little world of haze, this post-college, what am I supposed to do now kind of gloom. The kind of gloom that makes you want to eat Twix bars in the Gelson's grocery store parking lot, hypothetically, of course. I didn't thrive in college. I survived college. I'm embarrassed, humiliated even, to admit that I merely survived. I endured a certain solitudinal loneliness I didn't even understand. I was supposed to be happy-go-lucky and seize every exceptional opportunity that could come my way with an Ivy League deal. Instead, I nursed myself with romantic movies, alone, always alone, in dark theaters on the Upper West Side of Manhattan, with popcorn, falafel sandwiches, and large carrots, with bagels and strange health food store brand cookies, with calls to my mother. I nursed myself with these small pleasures. Could I even call them pleasures? Little stop gaps between the solitude of waking, walking to class, coming back to my dorm room, all the while wishing I were an Orthodox Jew. They seem to have the best social life, their own cafeteria, and group weekend trips for Shabbat. In my occasional social moments in the halls of Columbia, I pretended to be far jollier and smoother than I ever felt. But I mostly performed for an audience of one. Me. And even I didn't believe me. But I did know I missed what I used to be. I missed myself. I missed my mother, our strange twosome, the long talks, the bad TV, the seminars, and slow drives critiquing our favorite houses. I missed what we were. I missed what we all could have been, all four of us, if only. Megan, as for this wild whatever travel idea, consider it a mere concept, which may be getting in the way of your thinking. See this cup here? Oh, no. Here comes the cup analogy. He raised his empty recycled coffee cup, one from a cupboard full he collected and reused from Starbucks. This cup is not a cup. It's a collection of molecules, of energy. It looks like a cup. We call it a cup. But it's our concept cup that gets in the way, he said while pointing to his temples when he said the word concept. Do you see what I'm saying? I kept walking in silence, head down, looking at my sneakers in the sand. Not exactly. Usually, I pretended he made sense to please him. Cup, energy, molecules, wilderness course. How you gonna dot to dot that one together, Megan? I can't find the thread. It just sounds like a thumbs down to my plan. My job normally? To be the emperor has no clothes kid, the truth teller, the joker in the king's court to tell him with levity when something didn't make sense to anybody else. But I was weary of interpreting his abstractions. I'd been in the what is he really saying? I don't think even he knows metaphor deciphering Olympic training camp for as long as I knew how to speak. Despite decades of rigorous verbal gymnastics and getting closer than most, I'd never even gotten close to winning a medal. Maybe the cup thing is about Starbucks. The only part I do get, he won't be magically offering to kick in on my Rocky Mountain High tuition. We both turned to stare at the beach, our faces toward the set. The wedge was famous for the way the waves seized up and broke so close in. And when they break abruptly without peeling down the line, like today, they call that closing out. There's work to think of, he went on. My father hadn't believed in college. He went to work for his father after his brother was killed in World War II. Dad loved college, but that luxurious option was taken 2 years in. As for getting a job, I didn't mind working. I already had a job. Two, actually. It wasn't about that. It was this larger thing, this question of being alive, how to be really alive. In my Lawrence class, he says we must learn to be pragmatic, be realistic. But isn't part of youth being encouraged to dream? But Dad, I'm paying for it myself. I'm not asking. I trail off. I stare at the stormy winter set rolling in. My body vibrates as I struggle to ignore my dad's critique. I don't like misbehaving. I'd had the summer jobs, the good grades, the on-time and under-budget graduation. But there's this voice inside telling me it's essential to break out of fixating on pleasing the people around me. So I carry around the goddamn brochure of the backcountry trips I can't afford. I carry it everywhere, in the car, in my purse, to the gym, on the elliptical, in the bathroom, in the break room at work. At night, before studying the brochure again, I stuff my tip money in a white paper box to gather the tuition. I study each catalog picture with the seriousness of a scientist dissecting a corpse. It's as though I believe that some part of me that needs resurrecting will be found in those photographs. Something about the harsh-looking weather, the thick storm gear. That stormy weather matches something in my interior. And if I am ever going to do anything with my life, I feel I need to wrestle and make peace with those dark forces. Or at least begin the conversation properly. Introduce myself, boldly, instead of this meek, moping, rule-following type who has forgotten what it means to say boo. 11 months post-graduation. Location, Cochrane, Chile. It's 6 months since the wedge chat with Dad, and I've earned my tuition serving one tremendous amount of beer. But waiting tables couldn't feel further away from what I'm doing now at the Wilderness Program's home base, a small farm tucked under an escarpment not far from Cerro Castillo. I discuss with Liam, our tells-it-like-it-is, even-if-it's-embarrassing, head sea kayaking teacher, how many tampons I'll need for the next 3 months. He looks at my motherload of Tampax and asks, "Do you honestly need this many?" I guess I look as though braced for the tsunami of all menstrual cycles. And some 6 weeks after the tampon discussion, my backpack rests squarely on my hips, its weight evenly distributed between the massive straps around my waist and shoulder blades. Weighing upwards of 80 pounds, it is more than three-quarters of my body weight, a challenging load, made more so by the fact that I'm 3,000% confident I broke a couple of ribs 2 days ago when a horse threw my mountain instructor Tim and me during a river crossing. I've been hiding it, pretending I'm barely injured. I don't want to be medically evacuated, and 800 milligrams of ibuprofen 4 times a day is making it all possible. Up until the horse-throwing moment, I had been gobbling up any conversation with Tim, the shy, sometimes playful, yet confident mountain expedition head teacher. We could have talked about lawnmower repair, and I would have been riveted. I mostly enjoyed holding onto him on that horse, feeling his back close to my chest. We talked about primates and rock climbing and poetry and spotted hyenas. This one conversation was worth the broken ribs. All the more reason not to evac to see a doctor. What do they do for cracked ribs anyway? Don't they just heal on their own? Maybe the backpack will compress them back together. I will not leave voluntarily. Difficulty taking deep breaths and the hideous pain I feel lifting my arms pales compared to the joy brought by my first 75 days in the Chilean backcountry. So, vitamin IBU, it is. My life has begun. 75 days of firsts. First transport in a cattle truck instead of a bus. First chart. First 1 to 50,000 scale map. First time knowing the difference between a chart and a map. First condor. First time planning an off-trail route. First self-assembled kayak, heavy with a month of food. First compass bearing. First fjord crossing. First campsite search at high tide. First miscalculation of high tide. First flooded tent at 2 a.m. First time to run out of food before the resupply. First resupply. First off-trail travel. First moraine. First plastic boot. First crampon. First ice axe. First glacier. First self-arrest. First snow anchor. First ice climb. First herb bread made from scratch by Twiggy Fire. First calafate berry. First puma. First time to lead a group. First travel above treeline on unmapped mountain passes. First getting lost, like really lost. First accidental wander into Argentina. First river crossing. First mate. First coffee for that matter, but the best kind, South American and thick like espresso, with a dash of wild mint. First glacier lily salad, first bivy, first southern cross, first biting black flies. First 75 days without a single look in a mirror. First 75 days without one shower. First 75 days sleeping outside. First time I could feel up close how broad and wild the world is. First time I ate breakfast and dinner in a family-like group since I turned 13. First time not bracing for when my parents would blow apart. To know the strange satisfaction and adrenaline rush of being truly lost, not metaphorically lost or emotionally thrown off balance, but geographically lost, I was oddly comfortable, even if it went on for days in literal mapless terrain through unnamed river valleys and unmarked glaciated peaks surrounding Mount San Valentin. Suddenly, my external experience matched my internal one, not just lost on the inside, but technically lost on the outside. For the first time, my nervous system could rest. And I had company, a whole group of people navigating along with me. Navigating difficult terrain requires that you study an environment, learn how not to become overwhelmed by obstacles larger than you. To cross a river, timing is everything. Wait till morning when the water is low, face upriver, as directly facing the resistance helps keep you steady. To stay balanced, go slowly and look for broad water. Wider sections are typically shallower. Should the unexpected happen, these spots mean a safer washout downriver. Avoid getting caught in a strainer. And to live nomadically with a small group feels natural and deeply soothing. At the end of the day, we remain a herding species. Spending each night together after a hard day of travel and navigation didn't happen in my house or any family I knew. There may be actual magic in making a group a hot beverage with water you went in search of yourself, making each drink how you know each tentmate likes it, and then gathering around the stove in an intimate circle to talk of the day's unfolding, of nothing much, simply easy talk. I think that's what family is supposed to feel like. A group that works together, regroups together, and helps one another make life a little more comfortable, looking out for those around and among you. One person erects the tent, another might lay out the sleeping bags, while the other makes dinner. Protection, nourishment, comfort. In the end, it's not that complicated. Day 75. Location, Lago Esmeralda, Chile. I must be in love because I have diarrhea. I've had it since our mountaineering course leader Tim and I admitted to liking one another here at the end. Despite being college graduates, you can tell we are both idiotic late bloomers. I'm supposed to spend the last day thinking about what I've learned, but all I can think about is when my elbow might brush up against his elbow during our end-of-course asado. I'd much rather think about our little conversations on the trail and how he's earned the respect of everyone on the course. While we students from the beginning ran around like overwhelmed, gear-laden cartoon characters, all sweaty and disorganized, Tim always exuded this quiet confidence, teasing us over our concerns without patronizing. Before our shy meeting under a large poplar where he gave me my final mountaineering evaluation, I had taken to wearing sunglasses even in the shade for fear he'd catch me staring. So handsome, that strong jaw, shockingly blue eyes, like he walked out of the turquoise waters of Belize and straight into a Patagonia catalog. He wrote poetry and was a Stanford graduate, but he was also what I pleasantly experienced as a good guilty Stanford grad, not taking the privilege of his education for granted. His presence had an unusual calm and young innocence, free of edges and dark corners. Such a light-hearted teacher, I was transfixed. Whether watching him build a snow anchor or talk about puma behavior, he lent me a collection of essays by a writer named Barry Lopez. I can't get enough of it. Especially this chapter about the migration of Arctic snow geese in Oregon, the way they can ride and bank on the wind in tight unison by the thousands. A single flight can last 32 hours. When one of them falls sick in formation, a few will drop down and fly with them until they recover or die. The stories are so gentle, but there's this incredible power to them. Tim is like those stories. I can feel it. Sometimes I thought we caught each other's eyes, but I couldn't tell for sure. Ever since we were thrown off that horse, it felt like something changed. And under that shady poplar, I had no sunglasses to hide behind. Tim cleared his throat. Well, Megan, you've done well. He passes me my multi-page evaluation. I scan the course report card. On a scale of 1 to 5, nearly all 4s, 5s, and a few 3s. Camping, great. Safety, a 4. Handling that evac and river crossing, nice contribution. Ropes and knot skills, just fine. Great expedition behavior. Good group participation and leadership. I know that small group when you were leader at the end of our last ration was rough with Brent's fall and knee injury. Well, thank you, I say bashfully. This isn't like me, not to be able to find a good joke opportunity. To be honest, Megan, the instructor team and I discussed whether I was in the best position to evaluate you as, well, he looks down back at his papers. I really like you. So I worried I might be biased. On the other hand, perhaps because of that, I've gotten to know you better than the other instructors, and I think they trust me to be fair, regardless of those additional feelings. Additional feelings. I blush. I feel about 10 years old. I start pulling grass nervously. You say you like me? I ask, looking at him quickly and then shooting my eyes back down to the safe green grass. Like me, like me? Yes, like you, like you. We gaze a moment longer than is proper. We grin. It's quiet, but there's a lot going on. I feel heat in my chest and on my face. Out of what looks like composure mixed with timidity, he adjusts his arms in his lap, extends his legs out in front of him, sitting up quite straight. I speak. I like you, too. I mean, it's special because, you know, everything has felt so big here, so new. And then this. I didn't think I'd come down here and meet a boy. I mean, a guy. I mean, a man. It's like finding out you really like cinnamon and you hadn't even known what cinnamon tasted like before. Does that make sense? Cinnamon? Why am I bringing cinnamon into this? God, I wish I were smoother. He smiles. I babble. Clearly, I've been spending too much time with the group Spice Kit. We grin like fools, one big smile bouncing between us. So now it's official. We like each other. It sounds so 8th grade. I suspect we're both young like that, inexperienced like that. I've taken to daydreaming about Tim and snow anchors and coyote love poems. And after 75 days under one moon, one sun, I learned something else. What it feels like to fall in love. Here at 23 for the first time. With another sunset over Lago Esmeralda comes the course's end and my first moonlight kiss. Maybe it's the mountains or my new skills or the hard-earned sense of self-reliance or the blush of first love, but my life, my insides, have never felt like this. Magic. And that first shy kiss, it took place on that last day, that 76th day, when Tim was no longer my instructor. The entire course laid our sleeping bags out under the stars. Tim put his bag near mine. It felt so bold and scary. While everyone around us slept, I could see Tim lean forward, his tan face and timid smile framed by wild mountain hair and his 3-month beard. All this easy to see in the moonlight. He was so close, I could smell his vanilla mint lip balm. I want to kiss you, but I'm scared, he said. Me too. But there's no rush. We have plenty of time, I said nonchalantly. Inside, I'm terrified. I tuck my face a wee bit into my bag. That seemed to put him at ease. He leaned toward me, his thin green sleeping bag now touching my giant orange one. Our lips touched. My body went electric. It all stayed really gentle. He smelled like hard work and wood smoke. On that 76th day, we began. Secretly proud we had followed the post-course understood kissing rules. Because in addition to his patient demeanor and a cardiovascular efficiency so great, he never seemed to break a sweat. Tim was one of those guys who wanted to do what was good and right. And I really liked that about him. Chapter 16. Take an in-town job. Wilderness Expedition Food Manager. Purpose. dive into this romance with Tim and work toward, maybe, becoming a wilderness teacher. Work up the outdoor education employment food chain from the bottom. Duration. Expeditions run year-round. Equipment needed. To get an in-town job, it helps to have been on an expedition. As for the job equipment, standard commercial kitchen along with 8 million plastic bags. Age, 24. Relationship status. I hate the stereotype I'm fulfilling, taking a job I'm overqualified for so that Tim can take his dream job in the next town over. Other than that, I'm excited about my little, innocent, still new relationship. Cost. I'm paid a salary and provided housing. Location. Bellingham, Washington. I am 24 years old. This is Tim's and my second summer together. The first year, he followed me to Laguna Beach, and we rented a little place together. Well, I waited tables and studied for the GRE. And this summer, we are living in staff housing, a mix of moldy old wall tents and newly constructed Quonset huts. It means a lot of communal living with in-town staff and the cooler mountain teachers and guides heading out on trips. Turns out, I like the built-in social life of sharing communal kitchens, bathhouses, and a large gathering room. I even like the smelly, tiny TV room everyone crams into on weeknights. When I'm working or cooking in the group kitchen, I listen to a lot of Ani DeFranco. Tim turned me on to her. All that steel and stone are no match for the air, my friend. What doesn't bend, breaks. I work as the food manager for a wilderness branch in the Pacific Northwest. I am bagging food for an expedition going to the Waputik Range in the Canadian Rockies of Alberta. They head up tomorrow. Tomorrow, the counters of this room will be overflowing with bags and bags of pasta, pounds of black beans, and hot chocolate. I'm thinking about sneaking in a surprise tube of pesto for the instructor team, and I am listening to this Ani DeFranco song. You see, I don't want to be like steel or stone. I want to learn how to bend in the wind. And the world is wide open to me. I am smart. I am capable. I am kind. All my limbs work, and my hair isn't half bad. I am in love with a young man who's trying to step into the adult world like I am. We look and feel young for our years. I learned how to navigate a family, sorta, but haven't the first clue how to navigate the world in a way that makes an impact. Not in a way that thrives. Not yet. And I'm worried. The worry is sourceless, directionless, other than inward. And it pervades everything. I worry about my future, my family, a career, what I'm meant to do, how we're meant to live, what it means to die, what it is to commit to this young man. These are big questions, but bagging flour gives me a lot of time to think. Tim passes by and gives me a quick kiss, pulling a square of dark chocolate for me out of the pocket of his Patagonia jacket. Or was it his perfectly pressed khakis? We'll make dinner together in a couple of hours. After I clock out, I'll head to the open-air shower house and soap up under the sway of enormous Douglas firs. I will breathe in their sweet aroma. But the shower, it won't be enough. I can't wash out this worry. Chapter 17. Graduate School. Purpose. A program to award advanced academic degrees. Maybe mainstream education is the better way to go. Duration. 2 years. Equipment needed. Because it's Yale with a capital Y, I bet I won't have time to shop, so I buy all my food in bulk from Costco in Seattle and drive it across the country in my truck. Age, 26. Relationship status. Head over heels or head over hiking boots. Tim and I have been following each other across the globe. Chile, California, Chile again. He'll come with me to New Haven after an Arctic expedition. Then we'll commute back and forth while he's at Brown for grad school, too. Employment. Graduate NPR intern, full-time student. Cost. Staggering. We've just skyrocketed past any seminar thus far. That piece of paper from these ivy-covered guys isn't cheap. Deanie wants to help. And I'll sell my truck after I get my Costco food to New Haven. Dad doesn't believe in graduate school or its tuition. He cuts it close anyway, so better not to ask. Humiliation factor. Low. It's plain interesting to be among so many smarty pants. Location. New Haven, Connecticut and Providence, Rhode Island. His face. That's what it is. It's so soft, so certain. When Tim looks at me, I feel the sweetness wash over me, and that's a couple of years in. I love what he smells like when he's been in the mountains for weeks, when his bright blonde beard gets thick, his face tan, smelling like salt and Polypro. And I love that he's not only sweet to me, he's nice to everybody. We spent a day volunteering to teach natural history to the kids where Mom started a reading program for abused children. It's a residential facility out in the desert called Child Help, near Joshua Tree. To teach birding and ornithology, Tim dressed up as a stork-billed kingfisher and had them identify features of his wacky outfit. Goggles, wild climbing pants, colorful gloves. To teach conservation, he brought tiny flags we'd fashioned out of toothpicks for each child to claim and label their own miniature national parks on the property, all while dressed as a Southeast Asian bird. He had them in giggling fits. But it's not only his playfulness and intelligence. When I first saw him repair an MSR Whisperlite stove in Patagonia, I couldn't stop watching the muscles of his forearms ripple with the movement of his hands. As for being in the mountains together, I would hike forever with him, out in front or in back as the sweep. There's no one I would trust more if lost. When we practice how to build a 3-to-1 pulley system to rescue a hypothetical tent mate who'd fallen in a crevasse, I know he'd be the guy I'd want to pull me out, and I trust that if the emergency arose, I could rescue him too. He knows what he wants, not all these worrying antics I carry. In college, he was a mountain guide in various organizations well before he graduated. He's clear, even in transition. After we got together, he told me he wanted to spend less time in the mountains and more time with me instead. He figured that out so thoughtfully, saying he was ready to direct his experience to help his community. And when he applied to his ideal school, he got into his first choice without fretting. Who wouldn't want Tim in their program? He doesn't treat graduate school like a snobby stamp of approval, but more like a laboratory for the work he'll do. Am I entering graduate school to become more like him? With a master's in international relations and interest in ethnographic research, I hope to put my secret, embarrassing professional fantasies about writing, performing, and designing finally out of my head and focus on something serious that helps society. Mom says I'm so good with people, she's sure I'm meant to help. But doesn't art help too? It's all a little hazy how I'll use this degree. I hope to get as clear as he is. He's down from Providence. This morning he made me a breakfast of little goofy-faced animals, all out of fruit. An apricot with a mischievous grin, a plum, an angry professor, the strawberry like an upside-down Poindexter. He finds ways to make a present out of a meal, a cause for celebration. From his heart to mine. He knows I'm stressed about exams. I've passed him my paper on social standards and international trade. Did I mention he's the best editor for academic stuff? What more could a girl want than a guy like this, a certain future, and a couple of shiny letters after her name? Sometimes I sense I'm chasing something, but there's a certain safety at this school and with Tim that I cling to. Chapter 18. The Lawrence Ongoing Class. Purpose. To learn the art of self-government. Develop critical thinking skills. Duration, 9 years in. Equipment needed. Paper, pen, carbon paper to keep my own copies of my essays, graph paper to chart out our hefty 5-year plans. Age, 26. Relationship status, with Tim. Employment. GRE instructor, daily grill waitress, private tutor, graduate student, retail shopkeeper slash stock girl. Secretly, I always believed my clear career would come together after I fell in love. Didn't I learn anything at Barnard? My feminism has too much romanticism. Cost, a few $1,000s, many weekends over many months. As Tim and I now share expenses, I'm not sure Lawrence's class is an expense I can justify. Maybe I need to stop. Humiliation factor. Low. It's very academic in vibe. Location. Hotel conference rooms in Santa Barbara, California, or in upstate New York during the school year. The Lawrence years, as I like to call them, distinguish themselves by the sheer scope of the goal. to improve the quality of one's thinking in the same way a PhD in applied philosophy might. These Lawrence weekends are the main times I see my family. When not writing essays about the seven cardinal virtues or reporting on our zillion cultural projects to become more well-rounded, music, volunteering, politics, art, exercise, we ask Lawrence questions. If the question is more personal, we could ask for a private conversation at the back of the room, like an audience, with the Pope. I request to talk to our measured, corporate-looking Lawrence all the time. I look to him for the fatherly advice I never quite get. I know this because in the Santa Barbara class, my father sits in the row behind me, feverishly taking notes. Arguing with Lawrence isn't allowed. We instead do what he calls forwarding the relevancy of the discourse. But I push it, more than most. There is something about the messiness of desire and big dreams, strong emotional and romantic instincts that I think Lawrence's pragmatism fails to address. He tolerates me, perhaps because he knows I pay close attention, but I'm a needling force too. I present my question to him at the back of the room. How long do you think it takes to really get to know someone, to decide if someone's right for you for the long haul? I stand next to him in his director's chair. We speak in whispers so we don't disturb the writing period. I think it's difficult to hide something significant for more than 3 months. I think we put on our best behavior, likely more together than our private selves, but that's difficult to keep going for long. It's the whole public-private distinction we're talking about, to learn to be a singular voice where there's no difference between our public and private selves. 3 months. Tim and I had been together far longer, and no cracks had appeared, no huge split I'd seen. He's been as sincere and respectful as the day we met. Our conversations animated, our goals complementary, our sex young and sweet. Perhaps a little simple or sleepy. Maybe the word is shut down. What about when you learn more about their family of origin? Mine's no picnic, but how much would you weigh their environment? Megan, I don't typically talk from a psychological perspective. I'm only concerned with teaching you the skills of self-government. We can talk about this more, perhaps, but I need you to return to your seat. We're about to start another essay. Ugh! I hate this format. Humiliating. I sit down, incomplete. I need a reliable person to talk with. Back on the stage, Lawrence instructs us to write about the distinction between what he calls talking to yourself and thinking. Talking to yourself is lower quality thinking, a mistaken notion that there is a homunculus, a miniature you, living inside you, with whom you can talk. Signs of this? Brooding and reflexive emotion, rather than the clear-mindedness that comes from pragmatic reflection. I had too much to think about to make time to think. Lawrence's essay instructions faded into the background while Tim and his mother kidnapped my cortex. She was famous with all of Tim's friends and colleagues for her Katharine Hepburn meets insane Maine accent. Not just southern Maine, mind you, but way there at the tippy top, deep in the lexicon of the diphthong. She was also famous with his colleagues for calling his office at odd times to find out about Tim. A hovering helicopter of a mom, and not just a regular helicopter like a twinkly eco-star where you tour the Nepali coast while listening to Somewhere Over the Rainbow, but a seven-blade, 73,000-pound Sikorsky CH-53E super stallion, the kind that creates high winds and a lot of noise and throws sand in everybody's eyes. Even in rescue mode, those choppers can disturb anything from dolphins to ant colonies, depending on where they hover. So picture that. A helicopter, high winds, a lot of noise, and chop. Then picture Katharine Hepburn with a shorter neck. To say that Mrs. Anderson, I was not to call her by her first name, was that her old-fashioned New England formality or a freakishly formal rule to distance me? Was extremely proper would be an understatement. Let's put it this way. I'm willing to bet she had to smoke to have a bowel movement. All in cashmere sweater sets, paisley scarves, and monogrammed thank you notes. I knew where Tim got the good posture and direct gaze. Hers, a haunting one. Once her eyes locked on, they didn't waver. On our visit, I slept in the guest room, Tim, the room next door. After her divorce, she had crammed all her furniture from the family home into a tiny townhouse. Nothing fit. The beds were too big for the rooms, as if forcing a life she no longer had. When I awoke and popped in to say good morning to Tim, I wore sweatpants and a large, boxy pirate surf t-shirt, hardly the outfit of a seductress. He wore boxers and no shirt. I sat on the edge of his antique four-poster bed with wood, pineapple finials. My feet rested on the steps up to the bed. Tim's mom walked in dressed in her white robe. She looked at us and stopped dead. In a flash, she went ballistic. Did you two sleep together? Did you sleep together last night? Are you sleeping together in my house? She gasped and shrieked in a way I'd never seen a person do. How did she ramp up so fast? We went from 0 to 317 in 2 seconds. Tim sat frozen while she shrieked through her sobs. I wasn't spying. I came in looking for my eye drops. If I don't get my eye drops, my eyes seal right shut. Megan, what are you doing in here? On autopilot, I stood up, groping for a pineapple to steady me. Holy shit, this must be what passing out feels like. The room telescoped. With Tim still calcified, I tried to calm her. Mrs. Anderson, I swear we weren't doing anything. I came in to say hello. Tim hadn't moved, but his chest and neck were breaking out in splotches. She ran out of the room, down the stairs, and locked herself in her powder room. I could hear, frankly anyone could, her moans and sobs. With Tim still frozen, I decided to check on her. I tiptoed down the stairs and stood at the door. The crying eventually diminished, but she was still in there. I caught a whiff. A menthol slim? Huh, maybe she's trying to smoke one out. I headed back upstairs. Tim, not to point out the obvious, but I don't think I'm the right one to come to her aid here. I'm obviously the upsetting bit. I think you'll have to do something. He didn't smile or not smile so much as remain immobilized. Back in Lawrence's class, half the essay period had passed. I had 3 pages on the Mrs. Anderson thing. Possible actions. 1. Call her regularly to get to know her. 2. Have her know me so she stops thinking of me as her son's harlot. 3. Discuss with Tim how he coped with a sexually repressed mother. 4. Handle my concerns on my own. If I was to learn self-government, should I really expect Tim to provide relief? Screw the essay. I'll turn in these notes or write something fast at the end. A few days after the locked powder room incident, I tried to tell his mother a sweet story about Tim to normalize things. So this one night we were dancing with some friends after work, and Tim wasn't enthusiastic. But he knows I love to dance, so he danced anyway. Mrs. Anderson, he was so... His eyes fixed on me like a lifeline, but I knew from his expression and awkward moves, it wasn't fun for him. I said, Tim, you should only dance if it feels free. If it doesn't, you don't have to. I can dance on my own. Her eyes drilled down on me. I drilled back. But like a game of chicken, I would swerve first. I just mean to say that, she interrupted. Megan, I really don't know why you'd think he would want to dance with you. He never wanted to dance with me. Huh? Well, lady, there's a difference. I don't know how to tell you this if it's not completely obvious, but the two of us, we have sex. The two of you, no. He wants to put his tongue in my mouth and whatnot. You see, loving and sexing and dancing with someone you love is not the same as dancing with your mother. Got it? But I said nothing. I again asked Lawrence about it. If I, from my chair of self-government, want to evaluate a possible mate, what sort of questions might I ask? From your observations, is he a good man? Do you respect his values? Absolutely. Sometimes I almost think he's too good. Like he's trying to make up for millennia of global inequity all on his own, being a privileged white man. There's this uprightness to him. People literally stand a little straighter around him. My parents even commented. doesn't even like to walk down the street carrying nice retail bags. He doesn't want people of more limited means to be reminded they can't shop at, like, Banana Republic. He brings bagels to the homeless, like that. How does he care for you? Lawrence's exaggerated eyes zeroing in. He doesn't engage my neuroses, but I think that's an advantage. He's not the most emotionally expressive person. I suspect that's something I'd bring. Do you love him?
Yes.
And he you?
Yes.
Sometimes he says he doesn't deserve me. I never understand what he means by that. From your chair of self-government, go slow. Keep observing as rationally as you can. Okay. I just want to pick well, Lawrence. I want to use my best thinking to pick well. Chapter 19. Camp with the Chilean Military. Purpose. Point of view change. First ethnographic research for graduate school in international relations. Duration, 3 months. Equipment needed. Backpack, boots, tent, tape recorder, food, maps. Age, 26. Relationship status. Tim and I have returned to Patagonia. Employment. GRE and SAT test prep instructor, waitress, professional graduate student. Cost,